session number 16808, rule 21.
Spittle
021. Yeah, we'd already accustomed ourselves to this free and easy attitude that existed in the 7th Army Division, where the elite, the desert rats, the originals, although they were obviously much fewer in number now and were probably totally outnumbered by the number of intakes from various sources, but it wasn't long before it rubbed off on you. You sort of, this freedom, this atmosphere of flexibility, it was something I couldn't understand it. It sort of flowed over you somehow. So when I said to Bill, to old Albert, pull across the road, I said there's a lovely tree of peaches. It never occurred to me that I was doing anything wrong, if I was doing anything wrong. So we pulled across the road at these peaches, and I'm reaching up, getting these peaches down, you see, and handing them into the tank. And suddenly, a little boy says, "You'll excuse me, soldier. I hope you're taking those peaches off the correct way. Otherwise, you'll spoil next year's fruit." And I looked down over the wall, and there's a little lady there, made up like one of these dames in a Christmas thing. A bit sort of heavily rouged and all that, got a shawl round her, a little bonnet on, and spoke proper English. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, I said, they look so nice. She said, "It's quite all right," she said. "Take whatever you want," she said. "As a matter of fact," she said, "I'll get my man to bring a skip down," she said, "and take them all off and put them at the side of the road." So I said, "Oh, that's very nice of you." So we finished. I mean, after that, I didn't pinch them anymore. So anyway, I still took some more. And, you know, just a silly little incident that happened. And then we pulled back across the road because the tanks were getting on the move and carried on down towards the same. And, you know, you tell people this and you think, well, no, it's making that up, you know. Put it in a picture, that's how bloody stupid that is. But it really happened. I mean, it was the same as when we were back in Normandy. I told you, I believe, about the raspberries. When there was a nice, these tall raspberry canes. And I said to old Bill Barnett, Bill Bagley, I said, "Get your head up, Bill, I'm going to nip out a minute." I said, "Some raspberries." And I went and got these raspberries. And as I was taking them, I was suddenly sensed, rather than saw initially, someone was watching me. And suddenly there was a face appeared through the canes of raspberries, and it was a young girl. She said, "Hello, Tommy." And I said, "Oh, hello." I said, "Hope you don't mind." She said, no, she said, "They're very ripe," she said, "they're very nice," she said, "take what you want." I said, "I'm sorry," she said, no, she said, "quite all right." I said, "there's me nicking all the raspberries off the raspberry cane." But, you know, I sort of nearly filled my trousers initially because I see this face looking at me. But, you know, these silly things used to happen. And anyway, we carried on down to the same and eventually got to the bridge. And the reamers had built, you see. And then the reason became apparent why we were starting and stopping and rushing and all that, you see. Because once the tanks got on the move, they were saying, "go, go, go, go," you know. And then they come to a dead stop. And, well, when we got down there, the Red Caps were obviously in charge. And the RE blokes were down there, the reamer blokes who built the bridge were down there. And, of course, as soon as they said the bridge was all right, these Red Caps were saying, come on, you know, and you were rushing across, basically, as fast as you could, sort of thing. I mean, you'd imagine the vibration that this must have caused, because you weren't going over one tank at a time. You was going over in convoys. Well, after not very long, really, less than an hour, you'd stop. And the Remy blokes would have to go and check the bridge, tightening up everywhere, checking and all that, you see. Well, I thought, well, that's bloody daft. If they'd have let us motor across at a steady pace, you'd have probably kept the convoy moving all the time, rather than dashing across, terrific vibration, and then have a total stoppage while they check the bridge. But anyway, that was that, and we went across, and the war went on, as it were. Now, of course, we're getting up into the area of the First World War. So of course we started to see one or two cemeteries, like, you know, from the First War. And time went on, and nothing serious was happening. I mean, we knew that there was fighting going on in front now. Well, there had been before the same, but we didn't see nothing of it. It was most amazing. I mean, before, when we was in the Yeomanry, we was in it. Now, we were following it. And this particular time, I'd heard, like, from a schoolboy, from tales of the First World War, about the Menin Gates. I'd never ever seen a photograph of it. I'd never even been described to me. So I thought it must be some sort of a gate. And so during this particular night, they said we should be going through the Menin Gate tonight. So I thought, oh, keep your eye open. And during the night, we went through this place, this big archway. It was all cobbles. And I'll never forget it, because there was some light in there. It was illuminated inside. It got some light on. And I could see all these names in the wall. And when you looked up the dome as it went over, there were several round openings. I don't know if they got glass in them or not, but there was probably three round openings in the ceiling of this archway, like a little tunnel, short tunnel. And all these names all over it. And the noise was terrific with these cobbles with the tank tracks. And of course I find out next day that was the Menin Gates. Well, you know, most amazing. Of course I've seen photos since the war and seen on television and all that. But that was the first time that I ever became acquainted with the Menin Gates who went through that night. But the fighting went on, and we, the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, and us in particular, now became embroiled in the fighting because we came up into the coal fields round Lens and Lillers and Bethune, St Paul and all that area. And we were going into the coal field area. And of course, it was a bad area for tanks because apart from the cobbled roads and all that, and there was streams and rivers and canals and bridges and all that sort of thing. Small towns, one after the other, and narrow streets. And of course, you couldn't avoid, you know, you sort of couldn't say, well, we'll get out in the country and go past, because it was such a complicated area, so congested. You had to go through these streets. And of course, we were getting help from the resistance workers. I mean, they were there quite prominently now up there. But there was another trouble. We'd run out of maps. Once we crossed the Seine, we'd got no more maps. And they didn't seem to be able to supply us with any. So it boiled down to, to my memory, Tom, that the only people who got a map at all was probably the squadron leader. And he'd only got maps what they'd got from the tourist office type of thing, you know, or the schools. We'd been using war maps, which had every dike and ditch on them sort of thing. And now we're in country, we hadn't got a clue. And we was reduced to troop leaders having conferences with the squadron leaders, and the troop leader coming back with a piece of paper with a sketch on it, saying, well, we're here, and as far as I can make out, and this was the word that I kept using, as far as we can make out, started using mileage and distance, there'll be a crossroads or a fork junction or a village or... And it was all this ore business all the time. And he'd stop and then he'd sort of go off again and he'd come back with another sketch and we'd go on again. And then they came back and they said, keep out of trouble. You know, sort of, don't be too aggressive. Because the situation had become that the echelons were miles behind. If a tank got knocked out, there was no way that they could recover it. There was nobody up there to deal with any casualties. So they were telling us now to be cautious. And, you know, progress slowed down. But you'd still got to fight. And tanks were still getting knocked out. But it was a difficult situation. And But we got to a point where things seemed to settle down, and these desert regiments and that, they seemed to be really organised to me somehow. They was always trying to look for comforts. You know, whereas in the Yarra we just bashed on, sort of thing. And as I told you, the only time we attempted to have a bath, a unit bath, was a dismal failure when they got all that water and they finished up with a canvas sheeting the wrong way up in the hole. But, you know, up to this time, I'd never had a shower. A proper thing. All you'd done was, best you could do, was wash down, you see. And we was up, and I'm sure, I've always felt sure, it was St. Paul in the coal mining area. And they felt it was safe enough to use the facility of the pit head. And we went to this pit head of this coal mine, took our gear. I never forgot it because we was going to use the showers there, you see, what the coal miners would use, because they was there, it was in between shifts, obviously. There was nobody there. And we was going to use the showers. And when we went in, I could hear this ear rattling, and there was chains from the roof to the floor, and at the top was little boxes, and at the bottom was a big iron ball, and there was a lock on each one, you see. And it appears what they did, the coal miners, when they come in, you see, they'd change off the dirty kit and put the other kit on, but they would come in, you see, strip all the dirty gear off, go in the showers and have a shower, come back, unlock the lock, and this iron ball was a counterweight to this box what was up in the ceiling. And in the box was all their other gear, the going home kit, you see. And so what they used to do was unlock it, get the chain, pull it down, down would come the box, up would go the iron ball, and then there was the kit, you see. And then they'd fasten it at the bottom again, the box would be empty, except for the dirty kit what they put in from the pit before. And then they'd go on. And the next day, you see, they'd come, change into the dirty kit, up would go the clean kit, up the ceiling, and these are these chains with a breeze rattling these chains, the most peculiar. Anyway, that was, I'm certain it was St. Paul. And we went in there, the shower there, and that was the first shower resembling a bath that I'd ever had since we left the road in Normandy. All that time, you know, we must have stunk like polecats. You know, because I mean, you try to keep yourself clean, but you can't keep yourself clean to that extent. And it was in that area too that we had, well, when you look back, it was comical. And if you'd have put it in a film, I wouldn't have believed it. But we arrived in this town, this small town, in the dark, and the squadron, and we were down this street, main street, in a line, nose to tail, all the tanks, squadron of tanks. Troop leaders go off for a conference with a squadron leader, gone to get his sketch, and back he comes, their troop leader, and he says, right, and bear in mind, we've still got four Cromwells. So there's a troop leader, Taffy Ellis, who's a troop sergeant, George Ferguson, who was a sergeant, and me, troop corporal, you see. So we still get our four Cromwells. Back comes the officer, and he says, right, this is it. He said, we've got to go down the road. When we get to the bottom, we've got to go into the marketplace, across the marketplace, and we assumed it was square, and we would come in this corner and go across to that corner, you see. So the two neutral corners we didn't touch. He said, across the square, out the other side, he said, and we should come down the road, follow the main road, and we should come to a canal and a river, side by side, and there's two little bridges, and we've got to go down and check that they're both all right, you see. And he said, because we've got four tanks, put two tanks on each bridge, and stay there and hold them till the squadron can move down. You know, this was one of the advantages that I pointed out originally of having four Cromwells. Anyway, he says, follow me. You see, now he didn't say no instructions about where we got to go. He just said, down the hill, cross the market, you see, and that was it. He said, follow me, I'll take the lead, he said. Because he's got the sketch. So we go down the hill, gets down the bottom, it's a T-junction. You've either got to go left or right, you see. We go his left. He's leading. And within, well, a few hundred yards, really, and we're in the open, we're in the fields. So I thought, that's a bloody queer marketplace, this is. But I think I was the end but one. I was about a third tank in the doings. I thought, it's a bloody queer marketplace, we're all in the fields. So we stopped the troop, and on the B set, you see, where we talk to each other, he says, I think I must have gone wrong, he said. I think we should have went right instead of left, you see. So we said, some taffy or something said, good, me, June. I mean, I didn't offer much advice very often, you see, occasionally, but there's left of the troop sergeant, you see. He said, well, we turn around, shall we, sir? No, he said. I think if we carry on, the first turn right we come to, if we go right again, I mean, it's only a small town, we should bring us back into the town, you see. So, fair enough. I mean, sitting in a 34-ton tank, you feel pretty confident. So we carried on, you see. A little way up the road, we come to a lane on the right, so we turn right down this lane. There you go, then. Few fields or something, and then we come to a T-junction, and we turn right again. By now, it's obvious to the troop leader that it's a different kettle of fish going into a town at an angle that you only even got a sketch for, let alone, you know. So we come to a railway crossing. We goes over the crossing, there's a little station there, you see, and we pulls into the station yard. Four Cromwells, side by side. And the noise they make is unbelievable, you see, in the dark, in the night. So we had a little conference on the B set. Don't get it, have a little conference on the B set. And suddenly there's windows start opening, the lights start coming on in the buildings. It's obvious to us we've got to start and do something, you see. So it's decided we'll go back and start again. You see, we go back to where we started turning left. When we get to the point where we turn left, we just carry straight across into the town, you see. I'm a proper freak car, no, this lot, you know. So we turns round at the station yard and off we goes. Now, just before we got to the railway crossing, we noticed there's a big house on the right hand side, like it might have been a local county hall, with a little drive into it. Well, when we went by it, everything's in total darkness. Not a sign of anybody. And there's a little dip down off the road, you see, because the road appears to be higher, and then there's ditches each side, you see. Now, up in Belgium, in France, you had high banks. But when you get up into Belgium and northern France, you get ditches. You don't get high banks anymore, you see. And, of course, there is bad. I mean, with the banks, you can't turn round, but with the ditches, you can get disabled, you see, you can go in them. So it was a reverse situation. Anyway, we're coming back. Now, the troop leader's in front, Fergie's in front of him, Fergie's behind him, I'm behind Fergie, and Taffy Ellis is behind me. And we starts coming back, you see. Well, because at the yard, over the railway crossing, and what did we find? That this big house has obviously been the headquarters of a German unit. And they're pulling out. And there's a whacking great big lorries like furniture vans coming out this drive onto the road, coming into the town. And by now, there's about four of them on the road. Of course, they're doing the right thing. As they come out, they drive so far forward and then stop, waiting for the next one to come up, you see, to get a convoy. And there's about four of them out, and one just coming out, and brought across the road. And as Jeb is all, obviously, on the ground, in between the lows and that. And, of course, we had to stop. And there's only us eight, you see, we're all shut down, except the commander. Now, you appreciate this, that we're so far forward, apart from anything else, we're so far forward that even the Germans can't imagine that if he sees a tank in the dark, let alone four, it's natural for him to assume they're German. Because nobody is, you know, the British are not going to be that far forward. And in any case, they're not going to be coming this way, are they? They're going to be going that way. So suddenly four tanks come up the road, one beyond the other. And there's this dirty great big lorry across the road, which this bloke's giving him the come on, you see, watching the dark, so he don't go in the dark with the lorry. There's Germans dotted about all over the place. And there's this one who appears to be in charge. And suddenly he stops and he's got a stick of some sort. And he's going, he's waving his stick and he stops everything. And he's going, he's shouting and shouting all that, you see. And they reverse this one back, what's blocking the road, back to us. And then he stands there and gives a nice big Nazi salute to our troop leader and waves him on. I was in a picture, you wouldn't believe it. So we start off again, you see. He goes, Fergie goes, and I start to move. And old Bill Barnett says, "What the bloody hell was happening?" I said, "It's all right." I said, "They're Jerry's." And the next minute, more tanks aiming for the bloody ditch. I said, "Right hand!" And it jerked right, you see. And he's going for the other ditch. And I said, "Left!" And he goes, "Left!" I said, "Right!" I said, "What the bloody hell's going on down there?" Old Bill says, "He shot his bloody flap." You see, well, in the dark, I mean, the driver's got this big round hole in front of him. And in the middle of that is an oblong flap, you see, so they can shut the main one and still open the little one. Because they've got two periscopes as well. But in the dark, you can't look through a periscope and see anything. It's totally black. And he'd shut his flaps at the... He said, old Bill said, he shut his bloody block. And he'd slammed it that tight that he couldn't undo it. So we're going up the road, the driver's blind as a bloody bat, I'm in the turret, I'm having to come up in the turret and lean right forward so I can see the road. I was like, left a bit, right a bit, straight, go on, keep on, wait a bit, you know. I thought, bloody hell's bells. And then we comes up, the other two had stopped, you see, by now. So we comes up behind them, we had to get the pickhead off the side of the mudguard, because these had a pickhead put on separate for the handle, you see. So we had to get out and get the pickhead off to get it inside to jam to force the block open again, you see, the whole of it, because you got this handle inside on a spring type thing, and it sort of overexerted it when he slammed it that violently. And that's the first time I found out that poor old Albert, if he got in a crisis, he panicked, you see. Perfectly all right, well, the situation's all right. As soon as the balloon went up, panic stations. And that wasn't the end of it. Anyway, we gets the flap open again. And I told him, I said, "Don't you ever shut that bleeding flap again." And he said, "That was Germans." I said, "I don't give a sod who they was." I said, "You keep that bloody flap open." I said, "I'll bash your back of your head in." So anyway, we carries on again, you see. And of course, the usual thing, they start off, and instead of driving, assuming that the one at the back can't keep up as fast as the one in the front, off they go and disappear in the dark. And we start to follow him. Taffy Ellis comes up on the B set. He says, "I was a bit late coming, Reg," he said. Ernie Brayton, that was his driver, he said, "Do you know what this horse had done?" Because Ernie was like that. He was a bit of a daredevil, Ernie was. He said, "When he got to that last lorry," he said, "what was stood on the road," he said, "he stopped the bloody tank," he said, "and sideswiped it and pushed it in a bloody ditch," he said. "That'll give the sod something to think about." He said he could have got a bleeding track off as easy as anything. Well, he could have done, you know. But he just thought, well, I'm in a tank, you know. So he just stopped, pulled his tiller and nudged it off the bloody road. And then travelled on again, you see. And what did Jerry start to take now? Anyway, we carries on, you see. Turns up this, back up this lane. But when we gets up to the next turn left, which would have took us back into the town, there's Fergus' tank standing there with a bloody track laying up the road. And his driver, what had happened... There was a big stone building on that left-hand corner going back. And you've probably seen them in these factories. They used to have them in the factories years ago, because a horse and cart used to have these big drays with the big wheels, and they used to have a big hubcap, which if they hit the wall, it'd take bricks out the wall, you see. And they used to have these what looked like shells at the bottom on the corner of each building to make sure that if any damage was done, it was done to the horse and cart and not the building, you see. And they were one of these. And he clipped it with his track and broke his track. And so the tank laid across the road in the other, on the other side of the road, and the track laid out about 60 yards of it, flat as a pancake. Oh, gosh, you know. So all anticipations went up the spout. Now, when you get a track off of a tank, completely off a tank, it's going to, like the situation, it's going to take at least two more tanks to get him back on the track. And all this parity, you've got to get it over and join it up and put the pins in and all that, you see. Well, this wasn't the time to think about doing an hour's work on a tank. Because, I mean, anybody, Jerry, could have been sculling around. So what we do, the troop officer cables, puts his tow rope onto Fergie's tank. I itches his track up to the back of my tank. And Taffy Ellis is the only actually free-running tank following up the rear. So the only thing we can do is go back to where we started from. So of course we does that. We goes back up to the road where we goes, where we come from, you see. And parks Fergus tank up with the track off the side of the road. And then we drags the track up the side of it and undoes it off of my tank. And then the troop leader goes off to get a rollicking off the squadron leader, I imagine, for a start. And a new plan of action. So back he comes, and we're turning, we're standing there side of the road waiting. Me and Taffy, and Fergus standing there with his track off. Back he comes with his thing, because you don't bring a sketch back this time, because he got the first one, see. All he's had is a rollicking for making a cock up of it, like. They said, right, down the road, turn right, straight across the market. Right, I'll take the lead, he says. Taffy's behind him, I'm behind Taffy. Because they want to put two tanks on each bridge, they sends a 17-pounder Sherman down with us. He's behind me. It's bloody great. Like a bull elephant there. Compared to a Cromwell, like a bull elephant with a big trunk sticking out the front. So we goes off down the road, gets to the turn, round the corner, and all hell broke loose. Well, I'm on the turn, and I can only sort of see partway along to the Market Square, you see. The Sherman's behind me. Got his old 17-pounder at a nice little angle. And suddenly, it sounded to me, it must have been something like a 20mm pom-pom or something. And this gun's like, boom, 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 boom. And the stuff that was flying off these first two tanks was nobody's business. The bits were flying everywhere. Whatever it was, it wasn't big enough to knock the tank out, but it wasn't doing it much good, you know. And, of course, they stop. These first two, the troop leader and Taffy stop. And then they start to back up. And Jerry's putting these star shells up, and these flares are bouncing off the roofs. They're knocking the slates off. The slates are cascading down into the streets. God, you talk about bedlam. Nothing like it. And then somebody starts firing these flares up in the air, and it's all brilliant. You can see like daylight, you know. And there's this bloody gun around the corner going boom, 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 boom. There's these two tanks a bit flying off of them. They start reversing. And I start to reverse. And then there's this one behind me, this Sherman. He hadn't moved. So I thought, well, the best, quickest thing is to do a neutral turn. Because you're very slow reversing, you see. And I wanted to get out of Taffy's way, who's coming round this corner in reverse. So I says to Albert, I says, righto, Albert, do a neutral turn. I said, we'll drive back, because obviously we're going to drive back. So he spins the tank round. So, well, this neutral turn, at that time, they only had it on Cromwell's and Churchill's. And it's a special setup whereby you put your tank into neutral, in a gear lever, put your gear lever into neutral. And if you wanted the nose to go left, so it spun round that way, you pulled a right-hand tiller. And the right-hand track would drive forward, and the left-hand track would drive backward. in reverse, you see. So you just stood there and turned round on your own axis, what they call a neutral turn, you see, because you're in neutral when you do it. Put it into neutral, pull the tiller that you want to select. If you want to go left, you pull your right tiller. If you want the nose to go right, you pull your left tiller. And all you do is rev your engine up, and the tracks go in opposite directions, and you spin round on the tanner. So I said to Albert, I said, put her in a neutral, Albert, do a neutral turn, you see. So he said, right. So he spins it round, and as I say, as soon as anything